Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Warning, this episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing. In the winter of 1692, two girls in a parsonage in Massachusetts Bay begin to convulse, contort, and cry out at invisible torments. Their diagnosis was witchcraft. In a matter of months, 19 people will hang, one will be pressed to death beneath stones, and at least 5 more will die in jail. And centuries later, a tantalizing theory tried to explain the hysteria, a poisonous fungus in the village rye that causes hallucinations. This, of course, is the Salem Witch Trials, and tonight we debunk and dispel some of the myths surrounding one of the darkest chapters in early American law by exploring the ergot theory with none other than a whiskey historian. This is a study of strange. Welcome back to the show. I am your host, Michael May. I am about to introduce you to my guest, Drew Hanisch, from the Whiskey Lore podcast. Drew has done a lot of research into the Salem Witch Trials, and specifically the theory that it all came about because of ergot poisoning, which we will explain momentarily if you're unaware of that. But before I get into my interview with Drew, I wanted to share the basics of the Salem Witch Trials and the historical context of Salem Village and Salem Town at the time. Witch hunting was real. It's not just a Monty Python scene. In medieval and early Europe, many theologians taught that the devil could grant malicious power to witches. As a result, a witchcraft craze swept the continent from the 1300s through the 1600s. Tens of thousands of supposed witches, most of them women, were executed during this period. The hysteria peaked in two distinct waves in Europe, first in the 15th and early 16th centuries, and the second in the 17th century. Though this craze was waning and dying down in Europe by the 1690s, the ideas, legal procedures, and fear of devilish people crossed the Atlantic with American colonists. Not to mention that the Connecticut witch trials, which I've covered on this show, occurred a few decades prior to Salem. So witchiness was in the air. It was part of the culture of the time. And I encourage new listeners to go back and listen to the Connecticut witch trial episodes. Those trials were much larger in scope than Salem, though not as deadly, and they're often overlooked today, but they're a very important part of American history. Communities in New England during this time were living in hardship. Life was not easy. There are constant wars with Native American tribes. Colonists were arriving into a new land, which had a lot of political uncertainty. There were limited resources, and a lot of people were starting from scratch. On top of which, there were a lot of strong religious and cultural beliefs with the Puritans, and they didn't necessarily want others who didn't share their own religious beliefs to have the same rights and opportunities, which is very interesting since they themselves were running away from religious persecution in Europe. All in all, this context is important because it feeds the paranoia and social unrest at the time. The Salem situation itself began in January of 1692, when two girls, Abigail Williams and Elizabeth Betty Paris, started to exhibit strange fits and odd behavior. A local doctor couldn't find a natural cause, and whispers began to spread that witchcraft was afoot. In late February, neighbor Mary Sibley instructs Tituba, who is thought to be an enslaved Native American for the Paris household, to bake a witch cake, which was rye meal mixed with the afflicted girl's urine, and feed it to the dog to draw out the witch or witches. This concoction was imported from English folk practice. Tituba was soon accused to be a witch herself, and she ended up confessing that she was indeed a witch, and she accused Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne of being fellows in this demonic connection. The witchcraft hysteria ignites in Salem Village, the rural farming community that we now call Danvers, Massachusetts, and it spills into the surrounding towns. The trials themselves convene in Salem Town, which is modern-day Salem, before a special court, the Court of Oyer and Terminer, was established in May of 1692 by Governor William Phipps. And across 1692 and into 1693, at least 25 people die. 19 were hanged, one, Giles Corey, was pressed to death, and at least 5 passed away in jail. More than 160 people were accused of being witches, hundreds were examined, property was seized, rights suspended. It was, to put it simply, insane. Part of the piece of the puzzle on how this happened and why executions ended up happening is because the Court of Oyer and Terminer allowed spectral evidence, which is testimony about dreams or visions. To clarify, I could have a dream about my neighbor, and then I could say, hey, my neighbor was in my dream, she must be a witch. As accusations grew, and then the executions followed, beginning with Bridget Bishop in June, political and clerical pressure rose. So after October 29th, Governor Phipps dissolved the court, and the new Superior Court rejects spectral evidence, and the Salem witch trial crisis recedes, and no one will ever again be executed for witchcraft in New England. And now, my interview with Drew Hanisch.
Hi, Drew. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so appreciative of your time and you wanting to talk about this subject. And I'll tell my listeners, the whole reason I'm covering Salem is because you brought it up to me. And you were like, hey, have you ever covered Salem before? But first, tell me a little bit about yourself, the books you've written about whiskey, and also your podcast.
Okay. Well, I mean, I grew up in a household where I had a father who was writing books. He was a Detroit policeman, actually, and retired, and then spent his retirement years researching presidents' families' histories and doing genealogy on our family as well as presidents. And you could ask him anything in history, and he would sit there for 30 minutes and tell you every detail he could possibly think of about it. And so that's kind of what I grew up around. I ended up becoming a web designer, and that's what I did for 22 years. But I always had interest in the travel side of things. I loved history, but the idea of writing history to me seemed like that was something I would have had to go to college to do. And so I didn't really think that was my lane. And so I got into actually doing travel writing as a side hobby, and I started a blog called Travel Fuels Life. And what's interesting about that is that after doing some travel for a while and writing about it, I started finding that my travel was sort of frivolous. It was like, you know, other people are posting these same pictures up on Instagram. What is this all about? But I had started going on theme trips, and my first one was a James Bond trip across Europe. And so I went to every location I could scout out from the movies and then posted all sorts of things about those adventures. And when I got home, I was actually doing a whiskey tasting with some friends. I was not a whiskey drinker, but they were trying to get me into whiskey. And we were all sitting around and they were talking about bourbon and telling me all the rules of bourbon. And I'm like, something doesn't fly right here for me. These guys don't really seem like bourbon experts. And having a father who was big into history and, you know, let's find the facts and all the rest, I'm like, you know what? My next theme trip, I'm going to go to Kentucky and I'm going to learn about bourbon. So I planned out a 19 distillery tour in 8 days and basically video blogged the whole thing. And by the time I got done with the video blog, I felt like I was not only knowledgeable about bourbon, but I had fallen in love with the history of bourbon. But I was also confused because I would go to one distillery and they would say, oh, well, you know, the name bourbon came from Bourbon County, Kentucky. Seemed logical. Then I'd go to another distillery and they'd say, well, it actually came from Bourbon Street in New Orleans. And I'm like, okay, well, who's telling the truth here?
Exactly.
And so it sent me on a mission. I thought, I'm doing a travel podcast. Why don't I do a whiskey podcast? And I'll just kind of do a Ken Burns style. I'm, you know, telling the story, maybe a little drama in there. And then I'll interview people and I'll plug little bits in and I will debunk these myths. I'll do my own research. And so that's kind of where all of this started from. I was at a podcast convention in Orlando. And while I was there, I met a guy who said, you know, if you can teach somebody something, you should write a book. And so I thought, well, I could write a book on how to do the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. So I wrote that book, put it out right in time for a pandemic. Great time for a travel book. But it gave me time to work on my Whiskey Lore podcast because I couldn't do my Travel Fuels Life podcast. And now I'm up to 6 seasons that I've done of the Whiskey Lore podcast. And I started finding holes in my own research, which was driving me crazy. I am a stickler for the truth. I want to find out what is the reality. I love books with footnotes. Most of the whiskey books don't have footnotes in them. And so I'm going, where are they getting all these facts from? And it was around that time that I actually started doing research for a whiskey brand called Chicken Cock, which is a very interesting name. Well, come to find out that Chicken Cock's history actually goes back to some of the earliest years in bourbon history, and the people who owned the trademark didn't know that. And I was going through courthouse records. I was learning about the founder. I was completely dispelling everything about their history. And it got me interested in actually working on a history for Tennessee whiskey, because Tennessee whiskey has never had a book written about it. It's always, always Kentucky bourbon,
yeah,
or it's Jack Daniels, but those are the only two subjects. And so I was like, I need to do some research. Well, what was going to be a 150-page book ended up a 400-page book with 600 footnotes in it, with me documenting every single thing I found and every courthouse record I found and every newspaper I found. And that was really where things changed for me, where I said, you know what, from this point forward, I am a truth seeker. I am going to be a stickler for trying to find the facts. And I also had to come to a realization with myself, as we're going to find out today, that sometimes there isn't an answer, that you're never really going to get the full answer, and that you need to be content with that, or be content with the idea that all of your research will get thrown out the window if somebody finds a newspaper somewhere that throws all your theories out the door. So, yeah.
What are like two bourbon myths that you can debunk really quickly for our listeners?
Well, the first thing I can tell you is, and I actually read a book recently that said, I can definitively tell you that bourbon's name did not come from Bourbon County, Kentucky. Well, I can definitively tell you that it does come from Bourbon County, Kentucky. So
wow.
I found a advertisement in an 1826 Vicksburg newspaper, Vicksburg, Mississippi, talking about Bourbon County whiskey. And in doing searches, I can find plenty of examples of Bourbon County whiskey, but I can find no examples of Bourbon Street whiskey.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Yes. Now,
yeah.
As I said, somebody may pull up a newspaper article one day and completely debunk that, you know, hard evidence on my side. But as far as I can tell, that's true. The other thing is that you will hear, and this is something I'm going to start working on another podcast series here soon, and one of my first stories is going to be Old Forester. If you ever hear Old Forester bourbon, they say that they are the first bottled bourbon. And I found in 1859, there was a St. Suit whiskey that was called bourbon that was sold in New York City that was said to have come straight from the distillery and was shipped to New York. And I can't tell if it was shipped in bottles or not, but it was bottled at one point, either in New York or in Kentucky. Now you may go, well, that's not really a bottled bourbon. Then if they shipped it out in a bourbon barrel, it went through somebody else. Well, that's the same thing that Old Forester did. Old Forester was not a distiller at that time. This guy at least had a distillery. Old Forester was just bringing in whiskey from other distilleries and bottling it. So to say that they were the first pure bottled bourbon out of a distillery, no, that's not true.
I love it. All right, so we're going to switch topics, but it is related.
Okay.
Whiskey and Salem, they do kind of go hand in hand. And by the way, for those that think Puritans didn't drink or anything, they did. They did drink whiskey. They drank other spirits as well. And so that was part of it. But how did you first come across Salem witch trials and kind of tie it in with wheat or rye or any of that? Yeah, what was your start to this?
Well, it's interesting because this has been sitting in my list of things to research for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. And mainly because it's just a very loose tie to whiskey. It's really the connection of rye.
Exactly.
And the issue with rye is that in Salem, they may have been distilling rye, but in reality, at that time period, they were probably more drinking brandy or making gin out of rye. So it wasn't, whiskey really didn't catch on until the Revolutionary War. Otherwise, rum was the thing to drink, or brandy, or you had Dutch influence, you would definitely get some gin in there as well as English. So, and actually English wouldn't be until the end of the 1600s. So because of the Glorious Revolution, because there was no gin until William of Orange came across and he brought his native land's drink to England. So it's just really interesting to kind of flow through all of that. But anyway,
So
I didn't really follow the story. I knew it loosely. I've been to Salem before. I love going to Salem. You really get in touch kind of with the people who are involved in all of this. There's a lot of kitsch there as well, but still you feel like you were there at the place that all of this happened. So it's always been fascinating to me. But then one day I bumped into an article about rye madness, and that's what caught my attention. I'm like, okay, I'm studying rye whiskey, and now I'm hearing about rye madness. My first question is, this fungus that's growing on this rye, is this something you would distill out? Because that's where my brain is going.
That's what I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah. My guess is that yes, because of the high temperatures you're running it through, nothing's really going to survive coming through that. And so I doubt there would have been any effects from it through whiskey. But you have to think about that time period. They were making bread out of it because they couldn't grow wheat in New England. It was too hard a crop, too sensitive to cold and wet climates. So much more they would have been growing rye up there, which is something else we can thank the Dutch for, because they brought that over in 1625. And then everybody kind of embraced it. It became the secondary to corn as something for you to survive off of. So a lot of times, if you were having your porridge in the morning or whatever, or your bread, you were probably using the rye grain for that as long as the supply was around. The problem with that time period was there were a lot of, it was the Little Ice Age, so there was a lot of bad weather. You had seasons that were really bad, which created multiple problems, such as you would have prices rising because of scarcity. You have people hoarding the grain because of that as well. And then you ended up with maybe using some stuff you weren't supposed to be using, which is where this concept of rye madness or irgo, which is the fungus. There's a technical name for the fungus. I can't pronounce it yet.
I actually have that in my notes. So I'll specify what we're talking about, the theory behind ergot poisoning. The Claviceps purpurea, which I'm definitely not saying correctly, it's a fungus that infects rye and it produces a toxic alkaloid, ergotamine. And symptoms that you can have if you ingest this are tingling, hallucinations, muscle spasms, essentially fits very similar to some of the descriptions of the Salem witch trials.
So it's really interesting that this all started with two children in Salem in the winter time who came down with all of a sudden having fits and hallucinations and all sorts of things going on with them that nobody could explain. And by the summer, you had the whole town hysterical over what's going on here. And of course, it leads to trials where 19 people are put to death and one man is actually crushed to death by a stone. And so in 1976, there was a behavioral scientist. Her name was Linda Caprell, I believe is how.
I looked up the pronunciation earlier. I think it's Caprell. Yeah.
Yeah. So she wrote an article for Science Magazine, and she was basically saying that, well, you know what? They had bad seasons there. There was probably bad grain around. This fungus was a breeding ground for this fungus. So probably somebody ate this, and this is where it all started from. These two children ate it, and then it just spread throughout. And so she was really kind of connecting it to the whole Salem witch trial event. Now it's interesting because the first thing I wanted to know about it was kind of, how did people know about this, you know, during that time period? Because you would think the first thing they'd want to do is protect themselves against something like that. They'd be smart enough to know to avoid this black fungus that's growing on grain. And so I kind of had to dig in and learn the history of this fungus. And it's interesting because it wasn't this woman, but another writer in 1982 came up with a whole kind of history of this fungus and talked about that even the Vikings probably dominated Europe because they didn't eat rye grain, but the people who lived in what is France were eating rye grain, and they were probably weakened by this. And so it's really interesting because there were two strains of this. One of them they call gangrenous ergotism, and the other is the convulsive ergotism. The convulsive ergotism is neurological. That's the one that we're talking about with Salem. The other one, body parts fall off. It creates gangrene basically. And so two completely different directions with that, but people did know about it. And apparently thanks to the little ice age lasting for so long, this helped it continue to be a problem. And because people didn't know how to deal with germs and fungus and all the rest. So it was just a lack of knowledge. And so this woman comes up with a theory, and then all of a sudden, within 6 months, in the same magazine, Science Magazine, two psychologists come along, Nicholas Spanos and Jack Gottlieb, and they say, she can't prove that. There's no way she can prove that. And then they start dispelling all that she's saying, because they're saying, well, the big issue is that you can't say that if one person ate this in the household, everybody ate it in the household. And that would happen in other households. So anybody who was getting this would be contaminated by this fungus. Well, that actually put a dead end on my research. I was kind of like, okay, well, that makes sense. And so I kind of backed off of trying to research it any further. And so then I started trying to look for other things to find in this. I was going to say there is another tie to distilling, by the way. And this is another reason why this always stays interesting to me and why it has not left my list of things to do research on. And it is the fact that before these events occurred, women were the distillers in the household.
Oh, that's interesting.
And after this, it became a male occupation. Now, why did it become something that men took over afterwards? And so the only thing I can conclude from it is the fact that if you're in a time of witchcraft where everybody's talking about witchcraft and you are a woman and you're creating medications, which is exactly what distilling was, it was not for pleasureful drink. Most spirits back then were so harsh, they had to basically tamp them down with herbs or anything they could find to fix the flavor of what it was. So it was a spoonful of medicine. But if you're concocting something, you know, if you're creating alchemy in your home, and it's a time of witchcraft, especially if you're a woman on your own, you're a widow, maybe you're elderly, or, you know, you don't want to be caught doing that, because you're kind of putting a sign up on the door that says, hey, right. What am I doing here? So that was another piece that I really kind of got interested in, and it kept me going on it. But as I say, the problem that I ran into with this is that all of a sudden you get this guy is dead end. These two men are dead ending this theory. And, as I said, in 1982, another woman came along and said, no, wait a second, there is some validity to this. But it seemed that historians were siding with the two gentlemen from Ottawa that had come up with this original debunking as being the most plausible.
I did want to make a comment too. It's not about distilling or the rye, but you mentioned that women were distillers, and especially single ladies, old women were a focus. They were sort of had a target on their back during this time period. I did some other episodes about the Connecticut witch trials. And in my research on that, I learned that if someone was alleged to be a witch, their property, and they were single, their property went to the town. They can yes. split it up. They can divvy it up. So if there is an old lady, she's got a farm, she has land, she has valuables.
Yes.
It was a good reason for them to be like, well, you know, she is concocting something up there. I think she's a witch. Oh, and I also get her house now. So
yes.
Let's do this. Yeah.
Well, there was another thing, and along that line of thinking, because that has always been kind of my theory behind this. And I think I've even heard somebody in Salem, maybe at the Salem Witch Museum or wherever, talk about it being a land grab, or movies, or there have been multiple movies on that. And I'm sure it's been injected into my mind somewhere along the line. But as I was doing the research, I started, after I'd given up on that, I just started going into things that raised my curiosity. And somehow I ended up stumbling into a continuation of this thought process and going, maybe there is something to this rye madness idea. And it was all surrounding the guy, Giles Corey, who was an 80-year-old man. He was a farmer, lived in Salem, and he was actually called up. There were six men, I think, total, that were accused of witchcraft.
I think so, yes. Yeah.
And he was one of them. What makes his story different, besides his age, is that he was the only one that refused to plead either guilty or not guilty. And what's interesting about that is it started driving me into looking deeper into why would he do that? Why would he not proclaim either way? And according to English common law, if you refuse to plead, then you can't be put on trial. And if you can't be put on trial, they can't take your property. So it got me into this line of thinking, maybe this idea that they were doing a land grab here was real. So I started really diving into it a little further. So 14 women, five men all hanged at Gallows Hill. Four of the men died before Giles. I started looking into the women, or into the last eight deaths, actually. Because what's interesting about this timeline is that after Giles Corey let's call him stoned. We'll say he was stoned because it literally is what they did.
Yeah.
And we'll kind of describe that here in a minute because it's important to the story. That after his death, eight more people were put to death within 3 days, and they were the last ones. Now you have to ask, why were they the last ones? What was it that happened? Well, if you go back and you look at how Giles Corey died, basically because he wouldn't plea, they put a stone on him, a heavy stone. I've seen the stone. It's the size of a man. It's huge. It's a slab. And so they put this upon him, and he had this on him for 2 days that he survived under this old man. He's got to be brittle, 80 back in that time period.
Yeah.
And yet he refused to plea. And so they say the last thing he said, and of course this is probably lore, but they say the last thing that he said was more weight.
Yes.
And then he died, which showed a defiance that would explain why these eight people after him were the last. Well, the other thing I needed to figure out was why didn't they plea out? Why did they plea? Why didn't they just follow his? Well, because their court hearings were before he was put under the stone.
Oh.
And so they just ran through and took them out. Well, two of those women that were hung were very pious, and they were, it was seen as, there were multiple reasons why all of this stopped, but part of it was Giles Corey became a martyr at that point. Mm-hmm. And people were sickened by what had happened, and the government came in and said, no, this is getting absolutely ridiculous. What I couldn't find, though, was I started digging into the widows and seeing how many of them had their land confiscated. Very few. In fact, it was a situation where maybe two or three of them, the men were, as Giles shows, he was concerned about that, apparently, that he wouldn't plea. And they probably figured that everybody else was going to take his way out, so they weren't going to get any land after that anyway. But it is interesting to note that there are various reasons that was not the primary reason, which is what got me back into the chase on this idea of, is this Rye madness real or not? Because it reminded me that history is complex, that you can't throw a blanket statement over hardly any pieces of history, because there are always going to be cases where whatever you say is not true. We're human beings. We all react differently. So you can think, all of these people are the same. It's not true. And so when I thought back to those two men and what they were proposing in their rebuttal, I was going, well, they're talking about the whole community. They're talking about every household, and that the whole household has to be infected by this. They all have to be eating the same food. So obviously the whole household is going to come down with this. I started asking questions, actually, of like, well, could this just be a childhood thing? Could children be more susceptible to this?
Right.
That was my first thought, because the first two to die, or they didn't die, actually, they survived it, were two girls. And they were 9 and 11. And both of them, we don't know what happened to one. The 11-year-old, we don't know what happened to her afterwards. But the 9-year-old lived old age. So that wasn't a particular case there. I was thinking, as I started thinking about it, I'm like, well, wait a second. My understanding of Salem's history is that it started out as the first few people were in hysteria or were hallucinating. But then all of a sudden, now it became truly a witch hunt, where it was people pinning things on the others. Now, you can't put people who you're pinning things on under the same umbrella with those first two girls, who literally were having hallucinations and they were having fits and they were, they're a different category. And so you've already put a hole in the argument.
That's a really good point. And let me ask you about that too. So part of the story is that they claimed the slave for the household in the Paris household, Tituba, she had to make a witch cake at one point and like feed it to the dog. And it was a way, I can't remember if it's a way to ward off witches or find out if there is a witch. They were using rye in the witch cake or the typical bread. And that was being fed to the two girls of the household. You're right. They could have ingested.
I have two theories on this. Mm-hmm. One is that you could have a food that the adults don't eat. There were a husband and wife, and there were two girls. One was the daughter, one was an orphaned niece. So these two girls may have been fed something that the rest of the family wasn't fed. The other thing is, if you've ever been around kids, when kids get together, they get curious about things and they do things that they're not supposed to do. And kids will put anything in their mouth that an adult would never put in their mouth. So who's to say? Because this was the other piece. I went back and I looked, when did this occur? And what were the conditions leading up to it? In terms of the way the weather was and the situation with crops in 1691, the year before, failing crops everywhere. It was an unseasonably cold and wet year. That means we don't have a lot of crops. And if we don't have a lot of crops, you're basically taking every little bit that you can and you're protecting that grain because you got to survive until the next spring before you're going to have anything else to eat. So especially it was a reverend and his wife. They're not well-to-do people, so they don't have money to go out. And if the merchants in 1691, as I've found records of, were doubling the price of grains, then they can't afford the essentials. So maybe your grain storage area over there is running low and the kids are in there playing and they pick up something and they chew on it. And you don't know. And so you throw that into a society who is, and with a reverend as the head of household, whose first instinct may be to think that these kids are possessed, then they don't ask, what did you just, did you eat something you weren't supposed to eat? It's right. The line of thinking doesn't go in the right direction.
Right. And then tying it into the whole idea of perhaps they were poisoned and someone else wasn't. If we look at someone like Tituba, who I mentioned, she at one point, maybe even twice, she did come around to admitting, oh, okay, I'm a witch. And I think maybe she really like reneged on that later and then came back and said, oh, no, I'm definitely guilty of being a witch. And part of that is because it was a witch hunt. And they would tell somebody, oh, we're going to treat you more lenient if you admit to your guilt or name names. Tell us who else is a witch in town. And you would find that over a course of witch hunt history where people would admit to being a witch or name others because they wanted to be treated better or not hung or not killed or for a variety of reasons. So you're right. She, even though people at the time thought that Tituba was a witch, she's just saying that. She's saying it because she wants to be treated leniently. She's not necessarily poisoned like the other kids were if we follow that theory along. Yeah.
This is the other thing about history that's really tricky, which is lenses, because there are multiple lenses on this story. One is it's very hard for the modern writer to put themselves in the shoes of somebody in 1692. I mean, you can read all you want to read, but you're going to have sensibilities going on there that you're never really going to connect to, or an event that occurred. I always kind of put it back to, I was doing some research for music history, and I was noticing that the music on the music charts changed completely in 1964. And why did rock music, that's when the Beatles showed up in January. It's like, the charts changed completely in a month. Why? Well, John F. Kennedy was killed in November of 63, and that was a seismic shock. And when that happened, the American innocence was gone. Now we want to look somewhere else. We want to look outside ourselves, and the British invasion happens. Now, if you're not actually putting the news and the events and the things side by side with the thing that you're studying, you're never going to be able to put yourself into the lens of that is accurate on that time period. And so I think about Tituba and I think about the situation that she's in. I agree. You and I probably would react that way, or we might think of somebody captive acting that way. The hard part about it is that who wrote the story? You know, who is the one that got that from her to write it that way? And now you have to also take their lens into account, because they're going to have their own passions that they're putting in with the way that they're telling that story. So this is where it becomes, you know, really, really difficult to say with any certainty. And it's part of the reason why whenever I hear somebody say, oh, it's definitely this, I go, that's a challenge, because I'm sure we can find some holes in there somewhere that are going to make it very hard for you to be 100% certain on any historical fact. Even we can even talk about the news today, and we'll have multiple lenses coming on the same news story. So
exactly.
Imagine going back. I mean, that was part of what I did with Lost History of Tennessee Whiskey. I spent an entire summer reading nothing but stuff from the 1860s, 70s, and 80s Tennessee. And you want to talk about being like surrounded by a different mindset. It was difficult, but it was one of those things that I had to do because I had to understand why certain things were happening and try to get in the shoes of the people that were making all this stuff go on and how they would react. So I could at least get close, not perfect, because, you know, this is the situation with these two little girls. We can't go back. There's nobody to ask. We can't go to the barn and do some forensic evidence searching. All of it's gone. So all we can do is from whatever somebody has told us. And as long as that's all we have, then I say that this initial researcher was right to suggest that this is a possibility, and that to deny it is to basically just be stubborn in your thinking. I can see what the two scientists did, or the two psychologists did when they came upon this. They said, you know, and then they went in and they searched just enough to show their thesis was correct, and then they stopped. They didn't dig further. If once they found the answer they were looking for, they then didn't challenge that. Because that's what history's got to be. It's got to be, I have the answer, but you know what? It's probably not the answer. I need to keep looking and see if I can dispel my own truth.
You're just to clarify for everybody. Yeah. So you're saying the theory of the poisoning from rye is valid, and you have to consider it, even though there's good evidence to say maybe it wasn't, but you can't just be 100% in either way because of a lot of the reasons you've just mentioned.
Yeah, I honestly don't think from what I've researched that there is good evidence to dismiss it.
And this is what's interesting, and maybe I just don't remember as well. So please help me remember this. But when we spoke about this before, if my memory serves, you said, have you done Salem? Because there's this theory of rye and area poisoning, and it's not true. I can debunk it. Isn't that what you told me? And I think, and maybe I'm misremembering.
I did say that. And you know, what's interesting is that I went back and I looked at my notes for the debunking. And then when I started doing the research after that, I was like, you know, and it's really interesting because it's the way the mind works, and the fact that was my mind made up before I started digging really deep into research. And so I've just pulled that as an echo back from the past, thinking that I had found a strong tie, when in reality, that was my old researching method of basically kind of find the answer. Once you found the answer, you're good.
You're done. You're good.
And you're done, which is what these two gentlemen did. Was they got to a certain point, they got the answer they were looking for, and then they didn't go any further.
Right. I think it's fascinating. And I'll also mention, just because I love film, but the movie The Witch, have you seen that? Have you seen The Witch?
I don't know if I have. Is that modern or is it?
It's modern. It was maybe 8 years ago, something like that. It made by a filmmaker named Robert Eggers, who I love, and he's very much a researcher, but it's highly influenced. It takes place in the same time period and deals with a family that's been kicked out of their town, and things happen. I don't want to give anything away, but there is a slight nod that perhaps it's all ergot poisoning. But the influence of this theory has gotten out there. People do think of it. People do consider it, even though it is a controversial theory, specifically with Salem. But it does happen. It's not like this is a made up thing either. It is a very real thing.
Yeah.
So we know that it's real. We know they're growing rye. We know they had a bad season. And I love the thought too that you've brought up, not to harp on it more, but it's just me thinking through it, that it could have been part of Salem, but just not everybody.
Right, exactly. And,
It
didn't have to go past the first two kids. It's my understanding that it started becoming like the next phase of it was kids trying to maybe, or young women sort of playing off of it. That, yes. You know, and then the next phase was hysteria.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I want to ask you too, did you come across in any of your research the symptoms of the poisoning? Is one of the things I read about that could point it away from being actually what happened in Salem is that vomiting and diarrhea are some of the symptoms with the poisoning, and that's not what they were necessarily exhibiting.
Yeah, it's although in the notes I have, it says may occur, but they're not always emphasized.
Not, and also we don't necessarily have records keeping track of the vomiting or diarrhea that the two women could have been experiencing either.
The other piece of this is, is it a mild case? Is it they survived? And I have read that this has been a deadly fungus. So that was the thing that was sort of throwing me off of it too, because I thought, well, I mean, they didn't die. So, you know, could it have been that? However, if they just had it in small amounts, or maybe the fungus wasn't fully developed, or, I mean, there's a number of things that it could potentially be, but yeah, it's just hard to, it's hard to say. Now, they called it St. Anthony's fire because you also got a burning sensation from it. Yeah. And, you know, that if your kids come in and they're complaining that they're burning, their skin is burning, and you're a reverend and it's 1692, you might be thinking that is Satan. It's got to be.
Yeah. And I'm always fascinated with how everything's connected, right? Everything. And the witch trials, one of the most fascinating aspects of this situation is that it influenced America. This is the birth of our country, essentially. And the laws and the situations that happened then had a major influence on everything that came after.
And that's what I love about bourbon history, or I say bourbon history, whiskey history, because so many of our taxes are all set up around, you know, that was, we hear stories about that it was tariffs that paid for our money back in the early 1900s, late 1800s. But in reality, there was also a whiskey tax, and that whiskey tax had to be taken out. And the reason that we have income tax is because they needed to replace the whiskey taxes so we could go into prohibition in the United States. Otherwise, we'd have lost the revenue. What's interesting to me is that after prohibition, nobody was saying, okay, well, we got the whiskey money back. We can get rid of income tax now. Yeah. Nobody was saying, well, there was one guy that was thinking that way. It's so funny. I did find that there was one example of one senator who was like, yeah, we probably should get rid of this now. But he was quickly pushed out of the way. So
yes.
And I'm going to keep diving into this. There will be an episode on my podcast about it at some point, because I find it fascinating. And I don't know that I could fit it into a book, but I can definitely look at doing an episode around it. So, yeah.
Nice. I love it. I did not expect you to go where you went today. Again, I thought you were just going to come in and debunk this old theory, but now there's a bit of validity that you have to consider it could have happened.
Yes.
And I really love that. I appreciate it. So where can people find you and listen to your show or buy your books?
Well, best place to find everything is at whiskeylore.org. And there I'll have my links to my podcast and also to my books. But you can find my books on Amazon as well. And it's Lost History of Tennessee Whiskey and Whiskey Lore, which debunks 24 whiskey myths. So your initial question, there's 24 of them in there. And it's not just American whiskey. It's Canadian whiskey. It's Irish whiskey, it's Scotch. So I everybody's up for grabs when it comes to my whiskey debunking. So yeah.
Great. Great. Well, thank you so much, Drew. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me on.
You've just listened to A Study of Strange. Consider helping us keep the lantern lit, illuminating the unexplained, by subscribing to our Substack. Just head to the support tab at astudyofstrange.com. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.